Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Made any financial resolutions for the new year? We asked some folks at a mall here in Los Angeles about theirs.
Save more money?
To make sure I have everything in order, because it's like paycheck to paycheck for me.
My New Year's resolution would be to try to make the distance between the money that I spend and sort of the dreams that I know I have less distant.
Seems like a good idea. Now, want to hear my financial resolutions? You will, and Chris Farrell's too. Maybe you'll get a few ideas for some you might want to make. It's all coming up on the first Marketplace Money of 2008 from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Here's a prediction that the chief economist at the National Association of Realtors made just over a year ago. Quote, most of the correction in home prices is behind us. Oops. So much for the accuracy of the crystal ball, but we're going to gaze into it anyway. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
I wish the party poopers at the American Bankers Association would resolve to wait until at least the second week of the year to deliver bad news. This week, they reported that delinquency rates on all kinds of consumer loans jumped in the third quarter of last year. Great. Welcome, 2008. So what about the rest of it? The credit crunch, Wall Street craziness, dumpy housing market. It is prediction time, and Donna Rosato is here. She's a senior writer for Money Magazine. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be back, Tess.
What are we looking at for this coming year in 2008? Is it going to get any better?
With all the bad news in 2007, it might seem like this year isn't going to be very good. But I'm here to tell you that despite the litany of bad news, all is not depressing for 2008.
Good.
A lot of people, of course, are worried about a recession. And while we'll definitely see slower growth this year, the majority of economists still don't think we'll necessarily go into recession. And the good news about slower growth is that it's going to keep inflation under control and interest rates. And that's a good thing.
What about the housing market? That, of course, was the big story of 2007. And from what I've been reading, that's not going to get much better over this year.
If anything, this year we're going to see things get even worse in the housing market. Prices will slide more. We don't think we've seen the bottom yet. Some people are talking even into 2009. If you're planning to sell, that seems pretty grim. But if you are hoping to buy or maybe add on to your house, this might be a good time to do something like that.
All right. Well, let's get down to brass tacks, how we can make this really useful for folks. If you're in the saving mode, what's the best way to prepare for the year?
You know, it's interesting. We've been seeing the Federal Reserve the last couple of months reducing interest rates, yet you can still get decent yields on some CDs. Some of the highest rated CDs in the country right now are 4.5% and 5%. If you go to bankrate.com, it's easy to find out where you can find those. But that's been some good news for some savers.
And from what I understand, a lot of that is because the banks are so worried about the credit crunch that they're trying anything and everything to attract customers just to get money in the door, right?
That's right. There's a reason. They're not doing it out of the kindness of their heart. They need that capital to keep making loans. So they're trying to keep rates attractive. And so that should remain true. And then also the sliding dollar. If you want to travel to Europe, it's going to be expensive. But if you're investing in big multinational companies, you're seeing the sliding dollar give exports a nice boost. And that's been a positive and in general helps keep us out of recession and why some people believe that we will stay out of recession. But think big. Think multinationals with lots of overseas sales.
All right. Well, let's stick with the investing question. And 2007 was quite the whipsaw market. You had lots of highs and lots of lows. Are we going to see that continue? And what's the best way to handle that as an individual investor?
Well, it's true. Volatility is back. We may have gotten spoiled on the previous years, but in 2007, volatility definitely came back and we had quite a roller coaster ride, and that is expected to continue. Best strategy in a rocky market like this as an individual investor, stay in the game. Too many people make the mistake of getting out when things are not going well. If you are investing for the long term, as most of us are with our 401ks, you want to stay in the game and ignore the volatility. Stay with solid stocks and mutual funds and just hold on. Don't let the volatility rock you too much. Don't make any sudden decisions that you might pay the price for later.
All right. Donna Rosato is a senior writer at Money Magazine. Thanks so much, and hope your 2008 is terrific.
Thanks, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
You probably heard this week that the price of oil finally hit $100 a barrel, first time ever. And maybe you worried that the gas for your car might all of a sudden pop up to, say, $5 or $6 a gallon. You'd think, but so far, despite huge increases in oil prices, we're just not seeing those big spikes at the pump. Why? For some answers, we turn to oil analyst Barbara Shook. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
The big news this past week, obviously, oil finally touching the $100 a barrel mark. Why haven't we seen our gas prices go up with oil? I mean, yes, they've gone up, but we've seen oil go from 60 to 90 and now 100, and the gas prices have not gone up that far. Why not?
Well, I could say that it's because of the goodness of the hearts of the executives of the big oil companies, but that really isn't the accurate statement. They are not making as much money as they did when oil was, say, $65 a barrel and they were charging us $2.50 a gallon. But they're still making reasonable money,
right?
Charging us $3 a gallon for regular, every place except California.
Right. We're paying probably $3.50 or so.
Right. You pay an environmental premium in California, and it is justified because of the higher manufacturing cost for that grade of gasoline. Companies know that if they let the price of gasoline get too high, they leave themselves open for taxation. And I think they would rather give in to thinner profit margins at the market level than at the tax level.
Well, what happens if oil stays around $90, $100 a barrel? At some point, refining companies are going to have to pass that on to us, aren't they?
Unless the consumer finally says enough. I call it the American housewife school of economic theory. When the homemaker decides we can't continue spending this much money on gasoline, therefore, we will have to reduce our driving or purchase a more fuel-efficient vehicle.
You know, the last time crude oil hit a huge high, people remember back in the 1970s, and drivers finally said, okay, we've had enough, enough with the long lines. I'm not going to pay this much. The economy went into the tank. Are we at that point?
Well, I was at that point more than a year ago when I gave up a luxury vehicle that got about 20 miles per gallon around town and switched to the Ford Escape Hybrid that gets about 30 miles per gallon around town.
Right.
Yet, because of the price of gasoline, I'm still paying the same monthly bill.
So will you stop driving?
I've cut back driving to the degree that I can, and I'll put it another way, I can drive 50% more than I did a year ago for the same price.
All right. Barbara Shook is the Houston Bureau Chief for the Energy Intelligence Group. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me. It's always a privilege to be on.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here with the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. But this week, Chris, I thought we could do a little something different to start the new year. Happy New Year, by the way, my friend.
Hey, happy New Year to you.
How about we talk about our financial resolutions for 2008?
Oh, boy, which means we're going to have to replay this in 2009.
Check up on ourselves and see if we actually did any of this. Have you made any?
Yes, I made two resolutions for the new year.
All right, let's start with the first one.
The first one involves spending on travel. Now, usually when you think about a resolution, it's about saving more. But here I want to spend more. There's friends around the country that I want to visit. So that's where I'm going to be spending my money. That means my budgeting and savings has to be geared toward coming up with the sums that I can do the travel 2008.
I think I might have to steal that one from you.
Anytime. It's yours.
Well, I have a couple as well. I've already talked to my husband about the fact that we've got to open IRAs for ourselves. We both have 401ks through our employers, but we don't have any IRAs. So that's another savings vehicle for retirement that we really need to jump on early in the new year.
Bravo.
Thank you so much. Well, you said you had two. What was your second one?
Well, my second one involves charitable giving. And I realized in late December, my employer gave me a form and said, you want to do automatic payroll deduction. And
right.
If I remember right, I think there were six charities on the list. And I actually think I spent a total of 15 minutes doing it.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know if I'm going to give more money, but I want to be more deliberate, more thoughtful, do more research about my charitable giving. So that's you know, that's a goal for 2008, to think more carefully about where my money is going when it comes to charity.
How have you done it before? Just kind of, you know, you get something in the mail or you see something on TV and think, oh, I'd like to support that?
I used to sit down with the children and say, well, where should we get, not how much, but what would you like to give the money to? And a lot of times it'd be arts they choose or something about children's health. And that's one way we did it.
Right.
That kind of fell by the wayside. And now it's just been more convenience than anything. And taking advantage of a program offered by my employer. And I think it's wonderful. I applaud it. But it's not enough. And it's really not the right approach. I mean, I'm spending more time thinking about what computer do I want to buy than I am about where I'm going to give my money.
That sounds really familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have another one?
I do, actually. And I really, really hope that I do this year. It's something that I've been – that my husband and I have been talking about doing since about 2 days after Katrina. I vow to finally put together an inventory of my entire household for insurance purposes. And we're going to put together something called a go box, which we've talked about on the show several times, something that you have at the ready mm-hmm. to take with you in case of an emergency. Here in Southern California, of course, that could be something along the lines of, oh, an earthquake.
Southern California, yeah.
We kind of try to forget about it here, but it is out there. I actually know exactly what we need to do, but we just haven't done it yet. So we're going to go around the house with a video camera. We're going to tally up what everything cost us, get out receipts and everything, and make photocopies of all of our important financial documents.
You know, that's something that has been on the back of the mind list for a long time, but is a really smart thing to do.
Well, I think this sounds great, Chris. You think we'll actually get this stuff done?
Ooh. Well, there is something about going public with this information that does sort of concentrate the mind.
Yes.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks, Chris. In this housing market, real estate agents can get pretty excited when they spot a potential buyer.
Do they actually feel your drool down their back as they walk by?
Yeah. I'm going ka-ching, ka-ching. I hope they can afford it.
Cash Peters explores the strange social experiment we call the open house. And how's this for a job perk?
I get to witness miracles.
A day in the work life of a doula and an explanation of what a doula actually is. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. As we heard earlier in the show, a lot of predictions about the economy this year hinge on the housing market. Seems like it couldn't possibly get any worse. Home sales plummeted 20% from November of 2006 to November 2007. But lots of folks are still trying to sell their homes. And the most common way to do that is by staging an open house. Believe it or not, some people go to those events just for fun. Here's Cash Peters.
Open housing is a hoot. It really is. You get to snoop around houses you can never afford to buy while pretending you can. Everybody's doing it. Marion Goodman's a top real estate agent in LA. She says, and I'm paraphrasing here, that most people are delusional, though. Oh, and cheap.
Yeah, some are just totally dreaming and need entertainment for free, so they go to open houses. And sometimes they get free chocolates, like we're giving away today.
I love that.
I may buy it on that basis alone.
Just kidding. Nothing would make me buy it, because that's not the point. The point is to look and criticize. And I do, every weekend. But only at homes valued $3 million and up. That's the rule. I dress in my Sunday best and walk around making comments like I own the place. Or could. You know, hypothetically. The house Marion was showing that day was in Encino, California, and worth $2 million. So technically I was slumming it. It was then she told me, though, and this was a shocker, she told me that dressing up counts for nothing.
Some people are just raggedy looking. They have a lot of money. They don't need to impress me. So the people that come in with torn jeans and flip-flops might be a $4 million buyer.
I'm trying to pass myself off as like Russian royalty or something that you'd come in and go, wow, he's got the money.
Russian royalty doesn't have any money. The communists took it from them.
Rats. Anyway, I'm not the only one who visits houses he can't afford. For instance, I found this guy on the patio, and I mean, the way he was dressed, he could have been the pool cleaner.
It's LA, no one cares.
And can you afford this?
No, not even close.
So but why are you coming here?
It's fun to see what I have to work harder to get.
So you would come around this place just because...
Yeah, see how the other half lives.
And how you never will.
Exactly.
Why are you here? Why did he come to this?
We're looking to buy a house.
But are you really?
We're really serious.
Wow, how unusual. Real buyers. The house was massive, with a certain LAX Terminal 3 quality to it. High ceilings, great prairies of marble flooring. It even had this weird hose thing that vacuums the house for you, sucking up dust and dander and possibly, if you don't hold on to something, you.
Welcome.
What a cute dog. You want to keep that kind of dog away from the central vacuum system.
Oh, yeah, you've got a central vacuum system which actually sucked the dog up and deposited it in the garage.
Oh, good. Then we'll
keep the dog on a leash at all times.
What are we thinking?
No potential buyers.
Really?
No.
Why not?
He didn't brush his hair this morning.
The fact that he didn't brush his hair means he doesn't want the house. There's no logic to your argument.
Yeah, I know.
Now, what about this couple?
It might be his daughter, or it might be the second trophy wife.
Oh, maybe they're seriously buying the house.
Yeah, he wants to impress her. Bigger is better.
Here they come.
Welcome.
They had this certain look about them.
He smelled nice.
He looked good. Her hair looked expensive. And
could they actually feel your drool down their back as they walk by?
Yeah. I'm going ka-ching, ka-ching. I hope they can afford it.
Yeah, right. Well, they couldn't. After all, it's not your dream house, is it? If you actually have the money.
Why are you not buying?
Because I can't afford it.
So why even come around?
Because you want to know what's in the neighborhood.
But do you not feel a total phony when you come in here, looking like you're going to buy the place?
Absolutely not. Everybody does it.
You have no shame?
None whatsoever.
And no, neither do I. So here's what we've learned. First of all, look around for pleasure. Don't dress up, don't ask needless questions, and don't think you're fooling the agents, because seriously, you're not. In Encino, California, I'm Cash Peters from Marketplace Money.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Is 2008 the year you leap out of the rat race and start your retirement? Well, more of us are finding out that we either can't afford to stop working or don't really want to. So what happens next? Well, Mark Friedman's written a new book with some answers to that question. It's called Encore, Finding Work That Matters in the Second Half of Life. And Mark, let's start with how you define that second half.
Phrases like the young old have emerged, or other oxymorons like working in retirement. Mm-hmm. So you've got this extended period of time, a population explosion of people entering that period. What happens to these boomers in this new stage of life is so important.
What about the financial aspect of this? Because the traditional model has been, you know, you hit 60, 62, 65, and you're essentially done with your working career, and you have hopefully saved up enough money for that to be able to happen. What's the new paradigm?
Well, we've had a 50-year deal in this country, which is essentially animated by the idea of the freedom from work. When you reached a certain point, your reward for putting in all those years at the grindstone would be that you wouldn't have to work anymore. That became a version of the American dream.
As long as you saved enough.
As long as you saved enough.
Or had a pension.
And because we were trying to get people out of the labor force at a time when there were big labor surpluses, we gave people incentives to leave early. But now many people are wringing their hands and saying, we can't afford tens of millions of people spending a third of their life in subsidized leisure. We need to get people to work longer. And you're starting to see the beginning of a new deal, which is saying to people, if you will work longer, not just a year or two, but put in another phase of work, we'll make it worth your while.
So how do we make it worth their while?
We say to them, if you're willing to work longer, we'll meet you halfway. Will help provide financial incentives to doing so, but will also provide better pathways, a new kind of higher education, which can help people retool for this period of life. And I think we're also going to need to give people a break. We need a national sabbatical. People are working so hard in the middle years that they don't have time to catch their breath or to even think about what they're going to do in this new period of work that could be as long as their earlier career.
Interesting. How much of this is driven by the fact that baby boomer retirees, or shall we call them encore people, have famously not saved enough for retirement, and it's become almost a necessity, if not a desire, to continue working beyond that 55, 60, 65 age bracket.
It is a necessity, and the question is, can we make a virtue out of that necessity, a genuine virtue? Mm-hmm. Because a set of conditions are lining up where individuals' personal financial circumstances, the fiscal situation of the society, labor shortages that are opening up, and also an accumulation of evidence that continued working lives actually benefits health and longevity are all driving towards this big change.
Do you mind if I ask how old you are?
49.
And have you given any thought to what you want to do in your encore career?
You know, I hadn't before I started doing this book, and I'd always thought I'd have one career and I'd extend it as long as possible. But when I saw people who had managed to find a second calling, it made me look forward to this future where I might be able to apply my talents in a way that's distinct from the opportunities I've had up to this point.
Mark Friedman is the author of Encore, Finding Work That Matters in the Second Half of Life. Thanks for coming in, and although you're still quite a ways from it, good luck in your encore years.
Thank you, Tess. It's a pleasure.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Well, it's a brand new year, a time where many people make some big changes, but one thing that will never change is our desire to answer your financial questions. With me once again is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tess. How you doing?
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
All right. Well, let's get off to our first call. Jerry is with us from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing good.
But I understand you're not in Jacksonville today.
I am in Columbia, South Carolina today.
On business, I assume?
Yes, I am.
All right. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I work for a company that does energy and water conservation projects, and my role in this work is to verify the savings on those projects.
And what kind of savings can you get?
A lot.
Yeah?
The bigger the facility, the bigger the savings.
So I understand your daughter is getting married pretty soon, and like every good dad, you're hoping to help her start off the right way financially. What are some of the options that you're looking at right now?
Well, here one of the things that I was planning to do, and I've been accumulating some stock over the years, almost like an automatic saving program,
mm-hmm.
and I was going to use the stock to give her a little boost on her wedding. You know, since I've had it for a period of time, there's going to be some capital gains involved in it, and I thought, well, I can just sell it, pay the capital gains, and give her the cash. And the other option I was just going to ask the question on is, if I were to transfer the stock to her, I was just wondering if the stock value for capital gains purposes is the value on the date that I I transfer it to her.
Hmm. Well, Chris, I know that there are limits on how much cash you can give to another person in a year. So what's his best option here, cash or give her the stock?
Okay, there's a couple things. So you have a $12,000 limit where you just don't have to worry about it. And you can give stock. However, what does happen is the capital gain does get transferred to your daughter. Let's say that you give $12,000 worth of this company stock and it costs you $10,000. That $10,000 basis gets transferred to her. So when she goes to sell it, whatever price it's at, let's say it's $15,000, then she's going to pay the capital gain on the difference between $10,000 and $15,000. So if you want to pay the capital gain, you can sell it yourself and then transfer the cash. But I have one other thought to toss out there. Run the numbers. Maybe she comes out a little bit ahead if you transfer the stock and let her pay the capital gain, maybe not, just to make sure that you're just doing the smartest thing on an after-tax basis.
Chris, does that $12,000 limit per year that you can give away without any tax implications, does that apply also to the stock that he would be giving her?
Yes, because you could transfer cash or any other type of stock is used. Stock and bonds are usually the other two that we're talking about.
So either way, he doesn't want to give her more than $12,000.
Either way, most of us don't have to worry about it. But, you know, I'm in the world of keep it simple. So you do $12,000 one year, and then if you want to have a little bit spill over, you just give the remainder money the next year. And then everything is simple for everybody.
Sure.
When is your daughter getting married?
She hasn't given me a date. She gave me a season. She's going to be getting married this fall.
Good. All right. Well, you've got a target then. Well, best of luck to you and congratulations to your daughter.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Are you looking to start out a loved one on the right track? Well, let us show you the way. Look us up on our website or at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Well, we move from someone making possibly a good financial decision for the new year to maybe one that's not so good, Chris. Donald is emailing from San Carlos, California. He's about 25 with about $8,500 in savings, so that's a good start. Although he doesn't have anything invested, he has only one credit card with a limit of $5,000, nothing on it, no other debt. But against all his good instincts, he is looking at purchasing an engagement ring that he feels is well outside his financial means. Chris, he's looking at a stone that's priced around $7,500 and a setting that'll cost almost $2,000. This is a $10,000 ring.
That's a lot
that
of money.
Is a lot of money. So to buy this ring, he's thinking about opening a second credit card with a higher credit limit and then max out both cards to finance the ring. I wonder what you're going to say about this.
Well,
I wonder.
I think he's making a terrible mistake. I really do. And I think that there are better options. Look, you're going into a marriage, a long-term commitment. Why would you want to go into that marriage spending on a ring more than you can really afford? Because, you know, by the way, as you know, Tess, weddings aren't cheap.
No, they are not. Average cost $28,000.
So buy a ring that expresses your love and your affection and has thought, but it's affordable. And then a couple years from now, you grow, you have some savings, and you can afford the $10,000 ring. I really think that one of the things you really want to try and do is establish, you know, some sort of money sentiments because you're embarking on a lifelong journey where you are going to be mingling your money and sharing your money. And I think it's really, why add to the pressure by going into debt and buying something you really can't afford?
Well, are you trying to start off the year on a positive financial note? Give us a call and we'll give you a hand. Our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And now we're answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link. And stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. A woman in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, gave birth last Tuesday to a baby girl, a New Year's baby. Her second, because get this, she also gave birth to a baby girl last New Year's. Now imagine the party at their place next December 31st. Their first New Year's Eve in 2 years not spent in a maternity ward. Plus a double birthday party. Or at least we assume they won't be in the maternity ward. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet a woman who helps moms give birth any day of the year.
Take a long, deep breath in. And on your exhale, you're going to make a low moan, almost like a moan of pleasure. Exactly. And another nice deep breath in. Just sit up comfortably.
I'm Katie Wise. I'm 32. I live in Santa Monica, California, and I am a doula.
See how hard it is? And you're not in labor.
A doula is... it comes from the Greek word for woman's slave, which is not very glamorous, but the meaning I first heard was one who mothers the mother. So I help mothers and their families preparing for childbirth. I do a number of different things. Prenatally, I meet with them and talk about their concerns and their fears, their birth plan, although I call it birth preferences, because you really can't plan your birth. Once we're in the birth, I do physical support, emotional support, massage, hypnosis for some. The one thing I definitely do not do is deliver the baby. So that's a big difference between doulas and midwives. Unless something goes terribly wrong, I do not deliver the baby and have not, although I came close once. I remember a friend wanting to be a doula in high school, and I thought it sounded really strange. But if I look backwards, it completely makes sense. I saw a birth when I was 13, and my dad was a doctor and delivered about 300 babies, and my mom was a psychologist, so it sort of fits. I've been a doula for 5 years, and I would say that on-the-job training is way more educational than any of the workshops. You really learn the first time you show up at someone's house at 4 in the morning with your little bag and your little tools and a book about labor going, oh my God, how did I get entrusted with this woman and child? It's insane. There's a few funny things that have happened. One that I can think of was a dad who, he was just struggling with the intensity of the birth. And at one point he actually crawled into her hospital bed and put on her oxygen mask on himself. And he did ask if he could have a Valium. I said, no, sorry, it's not for you. I charge $1,500 a birth, 3 clients a month maximum. Some months are less, and some months I manage to not be able to say no, so I'll have 4. I probably make about $50,000 a year. You know, I love a lot about it. I get to witness miracles. I get to see God walk into the room when that baby's born, and I get to be part of what is, for most people, one of the most profound and amazing days of their life, and I get to do it once a week, you know, and it's such an honor. And then, of course, when I get the call at 2 in the morning, I'm sometimes like, oh, I just want to sleep.
Learn more about Katie Wise's job on our website, marketplace.org. A Day in the Work Life was reported by new mom, Francesca Segre. Coming up, we go off on all those hidden fees.
There isn't anyone I know, when they go through their bills, whose blood pressure doesn't start to rise because you know there's going to be something in that mail that doesn't belong there.
Okay, now chill. You can fight back. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Ever screamed at your cell phone bill? I have, literally. Kind of like this. There's the universal service fee, the relay service fee, something called CHCF-A. At my bank, of course, there's the ATM fee, my cable bill, the franchise fee, utility fee, and those are just the extra dings I can figure out. It's like all these service companies are gleefully rubbing their hands together and saying, gotcha! Well, according to Bob Sullivan, that's exactly what they're doing. His new book is called Gotcha Capitalism. Welcome back to the show, Bob.
Hi, thanks.
So I have to tell you, this book made me very angry.
Then I'm doing my job.
Well, you know, we all grumble about ATM fees and all kinds of bank fees. How bad is the situation, really?
The situation is bad, and I'll give you 2 ways to describe it. First of all, there isn't anyone I know who, when they go through their bills, whose blood pressure doesn't start to rise because you know there's going to be something in that mail that doesn't belong there. On the other end of the spectrum is what happens in people's investment accounts, where what sounds like small fees end up really being about one-third of the money you should have for retirement. The average 30-year-old who's investing a regular amount of money in a 401k account is losing about one-third of it to Wall Street in fees over time, $5 at a time.
You know, we talk a lot on this very program about how everybody needs to pay attention to expense ratios in their 401ks and their 403bs and their IRAs. But I think we still don't really have the picture. Take us through what that fee is, the expense ratio, and how we can possibly know what it's doing to our funds, because it's really nowhere to be found, is it?
Well, first of all, you will not find the word fee anywhere connected to this.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know where we came up with this term, but it's expense ratio. And if you work pretty hard, you can find out what the expense ratios are for the individual funds in your 401k account. But I'll tell you what you can't do. I defy anyone, even the most professional money manager on Wall Street, to sit down with a calculator and give me an actual dollar amount that I paid in expense ratios last year. Because what happens is instead of buying 5.23 shares of a mutual fund, you buy 5.18, and effectively the other 0.05 goes into the pocket of a money manager. Now, again, those are tiny fractions. When you add them together over 30 years, it can literally take up, you know, 25 to 50% of the money you should have at retirement instead will have gone to fees.
I was stunned by some of the other factors that you brought up in the book. Tell us about the revenue sharing angle of all this, what you call kickbacks, and how that becomes a fee for all of us.
And it happens at almost every company. So I'm sure you've wondered somewhere along the line why when you invest money in your 401k, you don't have 10,000 mutual funds to pick from. You only have 5 or 6, or if you have a really good plan, maybe you have 15. That's because your company contracts with an outside company that administers the 401k plan, and they probably do it, quote unquote, for free. But what's really happening is that all the mutual fund companies market like crazy to the 401k administrators. Think of them as the middle person in this transaction. In order to attract your company's administrator, they split the money, essentially, with the administrator, who's making tens of millions of dollars by managing your account, not directly from you, but instead they're taking it out of the profits you should have from your investment vehicles.
So how does that have an impact on me as the individual?
Let me just break it down into simple numbers to avoid making it too complicated. But if your fund has a 2% fee every year, essentially a Wall Street fund manager gets 1% of that, and the 401k administrator gets the other 1%. And instead of having a 5% return, which is a pretty good return on a fund, your return's down to 3% now. So I know we're talking about tiny numbers, but what I just described to you was 40% of what you should have being taken away in fees by a 401k administrator and by Wall Street.
Is there any way that we can know exactly what kind of bite is coming out of our retirement investments? Is it possible to do the math? Because, for example, I looked on my Fidelity account, and it tells me that the only fees I've paid all year is about $17.
Right. That's your administration fee, yeah.
Now, I've made several trades within this year, and I can't imagine that I've only paid $17.
Well, they don't even really want your administration fee. That's pennies to them. What's happening behind the scenes is they are siphoning out their cut through your investment returns. You know, if your funds are making 8%, they take 2% of that, and that's where they make their return. But let me make you even angrier, Tess.
Uh-oh.
Because I keep talking about situations where you're making money, your fund's going up, and they're taking a cut of the return. Well, guess what? If you lose money, they still get the same cut. So you take all the risk. You might lose 5 or 6% next year, but you know what? It'll actually be 7 or 8% because the administrator will still get his or her 2%.
All right. Well, one place that it is a little easier to figure out what your fees are is at the bank. But this is another thing that drives me nuts. In fact, earlier this year, I noticed that I was getting these $3 service charges on my Washington Mutual savings account. I wasn't using ATMs or anything. I could not figure this out. Well, it turns out, unbeknownst to me, I was supposed to keep a minimum balance in that savings account. I guess I should have read the fine print, the mouse print, as you call it.
Well, here's the thing. Somewhere along the line, your bank probably sent you a notice saying that you now have to have a minimum balance of $1,000. But I was listening to you describe this, and here's one thing that companies really take advantage of. Somewhere in what you said there was, well, I guess I should have read. And that's what happens whenever you go to a bank or a credit card company or your cell phone company. The first reaction you get is, it's your fault.
Right.
You didn't read it.
Right.
Therefore, you need to pay. And you know what? That's wrong. If there's something that should have been communicated to you, it's the bank's fault for not communicating it clearly, not your fault.
So why don't we all complain more loudly about this issue? How is it that just about every service company can get away with these fees without really a peep from us.
The truth is, we have been putting up with horrible customer service from cell phones, from cable companies, and very few people actually take the time to complain. Very few people take the time to write a letter to their state attorney general's consumer affairs office, which is incredibly effective, or their local utilities board, their local cable franchising authority. So I'm hoping all you listeners out there right now that just had an incident with a company and you're not sure what to do about it, take the 10 minutes, go to your computer, type up a letter. You'll feel better, and it really will make a difference.
Bob Sullivan is the author of the new book, Gotcha Capitalism, How Hidden Fees Rip You Off Every Day and What You Can Do About It. Bob, thanks for writing this book, and thanks for calming me down.
Good luck hunting down those fees.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org.
We're back again with Getting Personal. As always, I'm joined by Chris Farrell, our personal finance expert. And Chris, let's get right to our first caller. Jay is on the line from Rock Hill, South Carolina. Hi, Jay.
Hi.
So I understand you're facing a major career change. Tell us about that.
That's correct. I've been working for the same company for 31 years, and we are about to be purchased by a current competitor.
Hmm.
And in that process, it is very likely that I'm going to be squeezed out.
And when might this happen?
It's going to be July 1st. We've known about it for some time, but it's now actually happening.
So what's the situation for you?
Well, I'm 60 years old, and I'd always planned to retire at 62. But this is a situation where I'm highly compensated, and I'm presuming that I'm unlikely to find a position within the next couple of years with a comparable pay. So I'm considering whether or not I should take a lower-paying job and potentially hurt my ultimate Social Security benefit.
Hmm. Do you have a severance package coming?
There is a severance package, yes.
And do you think that you could last those 2 years until retirement through severance and whatever savings you have?
Absolutely.
Well, Chris, is it a good idea to take a job?
I think it would be a good idea to take a job. The way the Social Security calculation goes is it looks at your entire earnings history, and then it adjusts it for inflation, and it chooses the 35 best years.
Oh, so it's not so, the most recent years.
No, that is, you know, where that comes from, if you look at it, a lot of the old-fashioned, what we call defined benefit pension plan, the pension plan you work for so many years, and then you get a payout based on how long you've been at the company. Typically, those are based on, depending on the plan, the last 2 to 5 years. But for Social Security, it's your 35 best years adjusted for inflation and then indexed. So they come up with a monthly average figure. You can go to the Social Security website, and they have an online calculator. It's very good. The one thing you get from the Social Security Administration, your earnings history, your sort of benefits history they give you.
Right. I get that every year.
Right. You have to fill that information in on the online calculator because it's not linked to the Social Security computers and your earnings history for privacy and security reasons. But you can plug in the numbers and you can see what your benefit is going to be.
Okay. Well, good information about Social Security payments, Chris. Does that help you out, Jay?
It certainly does.
Terrific. Well, best of luck and enjoy your retirement.
Well, I'll have to put it off another couple of years now.
Yeah. Well, then I should say good luck with finding your next job.
I thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Do you have a financial question that you're not getting an answer for? Well, why don't you visit our website? It's marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal button and tell us your story. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we spell that M-O-N-Y. All right, Chris, we've got an email from Gwyneth, and she lives in your neck of the woods.
Ah, St. Paul, Minnesota.
There you go.
Great.
And in 10 years, her first child will be heading off to college. Series EE savings bonds, which we've talked about on the show quite a bit, seem like a good investment to her, but Gwyneth is a little confused by the income limits. She is below the limits listed right now But of course, they don't know what their income will be in 10 years when they'll be redeeming the bonds to cover tuition and that sort of thing. So are they supposed to just kind of roll the dice and hope for the best here?
You know, I love Series EE savings bonds. I think they're terrific. Problem is the government's made it complicated. As you mentioned, one of the things is the phase-outs or the income limits. And for 2007, single filer, you know, just rounding off the numbers, starts phasing out a little over $65,000. If you're a joint filer, you know, the income limit is pretty generous, $98,000 to $128,000, you know, rounding off the numbers. Nevertheless, you have to worry about this issue.
So what do they mean by these income limits? Is that an income limit in terms of when you're able to buy these bonds, or does that income limit also apply to when you cash them in?
No, it's only when you cash them in. So you could be making $1 million a year when you buy them, and it doesn't matter. It's when you cash them in that the income limits, the phase-outs, kick in and they matter.
And so what happens if you've bought the bond and then you try to cash it out later but you exceed the limits? What happens to the bond?
Well, it's not the end of the world. It's just that you are going to have to pay taxes on the interest, which is why people are turning to 529 plans.
All right, so here we are again with the 529. So should Gwyneth not be using this double E and go ahead and go with the 529?
I would. By the way, I have my own portfolio. I have Series EE and Series I bonds. Like I say, I like them. I think it's a good part of her portfolio. I'm going to end up paying taxes on it when I cash them in. So I don't think she's done anything wrong here. It's a perfectly good investment. But in terms of saving for college, in today's world, what's far more sensible is the 529 route.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have today, but Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Just visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on the Getting Personal link. You can also call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks for the great advice, and I think we're off to a good start here in 08.
We are, and it's a fun start. Those are good questions.
All right. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Hopefully you got some time off to spend the holidays with family and friends. Hope there was a point in your vacation when you forgot about your responsibilities, maybe even what day of the week it was. That's what time off is supposed to do. Now, imagine having a few months away from the office with pay. It happens in Europe, and surprise, it does happen here. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler takes a look at one of the best occupational perks going, the sabbatical.
Call it the 7-year stretch. Every 7 years, employees at Intel get 8 weeks of paid time off. Diana Igusa spent her sabbatical in the Caribbean.
My husband and I rented a cabin on the beach in St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands, and we basically spent a month there just kind of hanging out and being beach bums.
Kicking back in the Caribbean was Igusa's antidote for excessive responsibility. The sabbatical is like a buffer against burnout.
I did a lot of snorkeling, and we just kind of got to know the local routine. There was a place called the Rainbow Beach Bar. Everybody went there to watch the sunset.
Now, 7 years later, Igusa has an infant and a toddler.
Hey, look who I found. Who's that?
Tiger.
She's just about to start her second paid sabbatical.
Mostly this time what I'm doing is spending more time this summer with my boys and having some family time.
Unfortunately, companies like Intel are in the minority. According to a report by the Society for Human Resource Management, only 4% of companies surveyed offered paid sabbaticals. Another 16% offer them without pay. Some companies place restrictions on what employees do during their sabbaticals. After working for American Express for 10 years, workers can take off between 1 and 6 months to do volunteer work. One employee mentored low-income children through an arts program. Bette Franzone is a spokesperson for American Express.
We know that volunteering is very important to our employees. We feel as a company that it's very important to give back to the community as well.
But it's not just about altruism. Working with charities, volunteers often learn new management skills. And Franzone says the program helps deter workers from quitting.
Employees do return to the company feeling, you know, more rejuvenated and even feel a greater sense of loyalty to the company.
That was the case for Diana Igusa. After decompressing in the Virgin Islands, she says she returned to her job in human resources at Intel feeling reinvigorated.
It was kind of a thing where I appreciated my job more because of that experience.
Some workers find that a timeout from the daily grind allows them to see their work with fresh eyes or approach it from a new angle. But if your company hasn't yet come to appreciate the value of a sabbatical, it's up to you to persuade your boss. Charlotte Anderson is the president of a human resources consulting firm called Amethyst and Iris. She suggests approaching the subject as a bargaining tool. If you can't negotiate a raise, she says, consider asking for a sabbatical.
I think it's really a very savvy move, because a couple of the concerns employers have about salary increases, number one is that they compound, and the value of the sabbatical doesn't compound. It's a one-time offering.
To sell the idea, try to anticipate your employer's needs. Anderson says you should come up with a plan for who will cover for you while you're away, so your absence won't create more stress.
A good employee, particularly a good manager, will have taken stages to make his or her absence less impactful.
Of course, some employees leave and never come back. They take time off to figure out what to do for their next career. With any luck, it will include perks like an 8-week paid sabbatical. Dreaming of tropical beaches from a landlocked cubicle, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, a special look at the middle class. Who's in it, and what are they up against?
I don't know how anybody can ever afford to have kids. I don't know how anybody can afford to buy a house.
We never can't make the rent. We never can't eat. But at the end of every month, it's down to the last penny.
Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, Stephen Hoffman, James Richter, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vakeland. Happy New Year, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.